Good afternoon. It is Monday, 12:01, and it's Eric Scott, and as always, our regular guest with his trademark yell.
Woohoo!
Yes, Chief Dean Rondo, the Wolfboro Police Department. Thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Oh, my
it.
Pleasure.
No Olympics, huh?
Yeah, no, I've been pretty busy, so.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, today I thought we'd talk about something interesting, and it's police myths.
Police myths.
And you see a lot of them when you watch things like Cops, because, you know, they're heavily edited. And so let's start with the first one,
sure.
Which is, there is no such thing as a quota of tickets, is there?
You know, it's funny. It's funny that you say that.
Or is there?
So I had a politician ask me that one time, back when I was a young patrolman, and Stan Stevens was the chief of police. And this politician said, "So tell me the truth. You have a quota of tickets, don't you?" And that's when I looked at this politician. I said, "No, there's no quota. Chief Stevens allows me to write as many tickets as I want." So in answer to that question, no, there is no such thing as a quota for tickets. Or let me rephrase that. For the Wolfboro Police Department, no quota exists. The officers can write as many as they like.
And is there a, when it comes to review time, does that come into it?
No. That's a great question, though. So we have a number of metrics that we use. And for those that watch the police commission casts that are on once a month through Wolfboro Community TV or come to the meetings, you'll see that I put up there the officer activity for everybody in the department, including myself, right, and everybody in it. It's year to date. And you'll see this number of metrics, you know, so some are arrests, some are cases, some are incidents. Some are, you know, assists to arrests. Some are, you know, checking locked doors, motor vehicle stops, warnings, parking tickets, service of subpoenas and court orders and so forth. And there's this broad category of metrics that we use. And I tell the commissioners, this is a snapshot to date of officer activity across the PD. So you can see how all the officers are just stacking up. I said, but be mindful that these officers are on rotating shifts.
Ugh,
right?
That's tough.
So what happens is you might get a guy or a gal that's on, say, 4 to midnight, and then their next shift might be 8 to 4. But at some point they're going to go to midnights. Now, midnight shifts if people follow me and when I speak at various meetings, public meetings, I'll say, you know, when we're talking about police shifts and midnights, and I'm trying to get a second officer on the midnights, meaning I want to hire more officers because I'm really concerned about that midnight shift. Want to have a second officer on that midnight shift. It's not because the officers are busy. It's because it's a dangerous shift. And it's one of the reasons why it's dangerous. There's not a lot of backup. So, but when you're on that midnight shift, you're not generating a lot of activity per se, you know, because it's very quiet, right? So there you have it, right? So there's a broad spectrum of things, metrics that we look at to determine if an officer is pulling his or her weight, so to speak.
Okay. But there's not one particular piece of data that that matters more
not at
than
all.
Any of the others.
Okay. Not at all. You might have an officer. You know, every officer develops a niche, right? Throughout it happens, and some are really good at motor vehicle work. Others are very good at solving crimes. Both are very important.
Okay, we're talking with Chief Dean Rondo of the Wolfboro Police Department, and we're talking about police myths. And one of my favorites, and we were talking about it right before we went on the air, is the lack of Miranda warning.
Oh,
that's a big
Miranda.
One.
Oh, there
goes the case. Oh, your officer didn't tell me my Miranda warning advisements. I'm going to beat this one.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. All it means is you can't use anything he says against him.
That's correct. Post-arrest. So let's talk about this one, because this is my favorite one. I had a politician when I was a lieutenant on an arrest that I had made on an individual who was acting up at the Wolfboro Inn, of all places. That became the big issue. Well, Lieutenant Rondo didn't read me my Miranda warning advisements. Oh, he's such a bad boy. Oh, there goes the case. I'm going to beat this one in court. Right. That was the myth. Right. And the politician says, well, you didn't read him his Miranda warning advisements. I said, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I did not. Good point. Yes. Great catch. Yep, absolutely. There goes the whole case. All he need do is go and tell the judge, well, he didn't read me my Miranda warning advisements. I'm walking. I'm innocent. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. So let's talk about this. Miranda v. Arizona,
mm-hmm.
Right? By the way, that was a case on appeal. And I want to say 66 or 67.
Yeah, late 60s,
it was in that neighborhood, right? And this was this individual was a murderer, and the police had obtained a confession or an admission of some flavor, and they were using that against him. And his attorneys argued that on appeal, that the officers didn't advise him of his constitutional protections. So the case was remanded back to the lower court, and that became an issue. So let's talk about that real quick. When a case gets remanded back to a lower court, in this particular case, what the higher court is doing, and I believe it could have been a state Supreme Court, but it may have been Superior Court. I just can't remember. But what the court is saying is hey judge, hey upper judge to lower judge, hey, you got to exclude this piece, right? You have to exclude this piece of evidence or everything connected with that. Because of fruits of the poison tree, that's unconstitutional, but you have to rehear the case. Now, typically, right, if the case is strong enough to withstand that, the prosecution will retry the case, which is what they did in Miranda v. Arizona, right, because it was a case on appeal. And they reheard the case and was found guilty, absent all that other information that came in. Right. However, the case is important and instructional because this is the first time we have the court saying, hey, government agents, hey, that's us, right? We are an agent of the government. Hey, police officers, you need to read people and advise them of their constitutional protection. So this became known as the Miranda warning advisements, right? That's how we get this. That's where the name comes from. So, you know, you have the right to remain silent. Everything you say can will be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney. If you can't afford one, won't be appointed for you. And if you decide to answer questions now without a lawyer present, you still have the right to stop answering questions at any time, right? So those are your basic Miranda warning advisements. Okay. they apply post-arrest, number one. So in, you know, things like investigatory stops or non-custodial interviews and or interrogations, they don't apply. Okay? They don't apply. So that's important to remember. And someone's going to say, well, what does that mean?
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, I'll talk about that here in a minute. So let me go on. So when I don't, and there are often times that I don't advise people of their Miranda warning advisements. And here's the reason why. Ask me why.
Why, Chief?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked. Because I don't need to. Because I don't need to. And by not asking them any questions, now follow the logic here, folks. By not asking them any questions, I'm not asking them to incriminate themselves. Correct?
Right. So far.
Right. Did I not just protect their constitutional rights? I didn't ask them a damn thing.
Yeah, I guess you did.
Bingo. There's the ticket, right? So if I don't ask you any questions, right? Right? Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies. I further protected your constitutional rights because I haven't asked you to incriminate yourself. If I don't ask you your Miranda warning advisements, what that means is that my case is so strong, I don't care what you say. It matters not. And often, a lot of the cases I have are prima facie, meaning I have the case on its face. I have, not only do I have probable cause, but I have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and I know it.
Okay.
And therefore, I don't need to ask you anything other than the obligatory name, date of birth, address, all that stuff that is administrative. Now, those are administrative questions, and those are allowed to be asked.
Right.
Okay? Hopefully that answered the question.
It does.
Let's go back to custodial, non-custodial interview and interrogation,
okay.
Right? And investigatory stops and so forth and so on. Okay. So the first thing is custodial, right? What is a custodial interrogation? Well, I've arrested you, right? I'm Joe Flatfoot, and I've arrested John Q. Citizen for something, you know? And it could be disorderly conduct, it could be criminal mischief, it could be domestic violence, DWI, whatever the case may be. I've arrested them, and I've put them in handcuffs, and I've told them, I've issued those magic words, you're under arrest. Now that, there should be no doubt in anybody's mind, that individual at that time is under arrest, right? They are not free to leave. They are now been seized by me, right? So this becomes a Fourth Amendment seizure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm taking them into custody. Okay. If I want to ask them anything at that point in time about the crime, and I'm going to ask them questions eliciting an incriminating response, then I need to advise them of their Miranda warning advisements. Okay. So that's custodial. Non-custodial, all right, and I'll give you a good example. Let's say I'm investigating a burglary or a theft, usually felony level, right? And I want to take a shot, and I want to see if I can maybe trip up this person. So I see them walking down the sidewalk. I go, hey, Corey, how are you? Oh, I'm doing fine, Officer Flatfoot. How are you? Great. Thanks for asking. Hey, you got a couple of minutes? I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. Yeah, well, I'm kind of busy right now. Yeah, this will just take a couple of minutes. Yeah, okay. All right, well, listen, Corey, you don't have to talk to me, right? You know that. And we're on the sidewalk. You can go any which way. I'm not going to stop you. And you're not going to get in trouble for not talking to me. I just wanted to get that out to you. Okay, yeah, so what's your question? Well, where were you on the night of December 23rd, 2020? You know, so now you get into the questioning aspect of it, right? What you've done is you've asked permission of this individual to talk to him or her, okay? And you've told them, hey, we're out in the open. You're not under arrest. You don't have to talk to me. You can go anywhere you want. You're not going to get in trouble for it, right? In other words, you can leave my presence, and I'm not going to stop you. You're not going to be arrested. That is a non-custodial interview. Now, there's a difference between interview and interrogation. Interview, you're seeking answers to questions, okay? And in an interrogation, you're really looking for a confession or admission, okay?
Okay.
So interviews and interrogations have different purposes. Sometimes you can transition, I have often, from an interview into an interrogation. But they're two different things. Number one, there are techniques in both. I love doing non-custodial interviews. And in fact, I will tell you, right, this is going to put the whammy on you when I say this one. I have done non-custodial interviews in prison. Right? And someone's, how do you do that? I had a chief of police one time ask me that. He was, how do you know that? That is a troll. You can't do that. Yeah, I can. And I have. And I will again. Because it's a great technique. You can't, how do you do it? And it just put the whammy on him. And this is when I realized I was smarter than he was. So the way you do it in prison, in jail, is you bring the incarcerated subject in your presence, and you do it in like the library. I've done it in the library at the jail and at the prison, where they have a door that they can walk out of. And you start it the same way. Hey, thank you for agreeing to see me. I really appreciate that. You don't have to talk to me. There's the door. You can walk out anytime you want. Man, you're not going to get in trouble for it.
Right.
I have met all the requirements for a non-custodial interview.
So if he walks out, what happens to your investigation?
Well, if I don't get, and that's a great question, if I don't get the answers that I need, I just have to seek them through other means. That's all. Oftentimes, this is funny. I had this case that I worked years and years ago. It was what we called a 7 Railroad Ave burglary investigation. We ended up indicting a number of people, I want to say 17 or 19 people on, you know, a whole litany of crimes, misdemeanors and felonies. And this is maybe going back 15 or 17 years ago, but a while ago anyway. And when I was presenting all these cases at grand jury, one of the jurors said, I was a senior patrolman at that time, and I was kind of serving in the role as the detective of the PD at that time. And one of the grand jurors said, Officer Rondo, I just got to ask, you know, you presented, you know, a number of indictments. And there were more coming. He said, and you got all these great confessions and admissions. How did you do that? Well, it's all in the way you ask the questions. And he said, Officer Rondo, can I ask you a favor? Sure. Don't ever ask me any questions. Okay. So I said it with tongue in cheek. So it's about, remember, I was coming in from the Army, and I was a counterintelligence agent. That's what I did on active duty. And I, you know, we worked, you know, a lot, did a lot of work in the counter drug war era. That's kind of what we were doing down there, among other things. I mean, we did other things as well, but it was, you know, you learn quickly, you know?
Yeah, I guess so.
So getting back to police myths.
Yes, police myths. The next one is that police officers get a certain joy out of arresting you.
Not true.
Not true at all.
Clearly not true, no. And in fact, I will tell you that I think officers look at creative ways of getting out of arrests because it's a lot of paperwork, because there's a lot of acrimony involved, because there's a lot of frustration. Yeah, that is definitely not true. And the paperwork is immense.
What type of paperwork are we talking about?
So arrest reports and logging evidence. You know, a typical arrest, though, you may process the individual in and out of the station in, you know, 30 to 45 minutes. If it's a garden variety arrest, it's probably a good 2.5 hours worth of paperwork after that.
Wow.
Yeah. Imagine doing like 3 or 4 or 5 of those a shift.
That's a lot of paperwork.
That's a lot of paperwork. That's a lot of paperwork. There is, you know, arrest packets are like this thick. You know, that's a good, you know, half inch. You know, your garden variety, there are forms that have to be filled out. Fingerprint cards have to be taken. Photographs have to be taken. I mean, there is an immense amount of paperwork that the officer is required to fill out. Required. So, no, that is definitely not true.
Do they end up getting overtime to fill out some
yes,
of this paperwork?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. If an arrest goes over their scheduled shift, they stay and finish that report. Because at a minimum, this happens a lot, at a minimum, I'll come into work and I'll have 3 or 4 phone calls waiting for me, you know, from angry parents, angry defense counsels, you know, this person's father, that person's father. And I've got to be able to bring up at least the face sheet of the arrest and say, okay, John Q. Citizen was arrested for, you know, DWI. The event occurred on Route 28. And I need the gist of what happened so I can talk intelligently to those concerned people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a uniform fudge factor when it comes to speed limits?
No. No, that's a great question. No, you know, you have... I can tell you how I look at speed, but no, there isn't. A lot of it is based on conditions at the time. So what a condition? So, you know, is it a school zone? Is it a school day? Is it daylight? Is it sunshine? Is it rainy? Is it snowing? Is it ice? How fast is the vehicle going? What's the condition of the vehicle? What's the condition of the driver? So there's a lot of things that go into that. Typically, what I would do is, especially as a younger patrolman, I would look for a vehicle that was going 11 miles an hour or more over the posted speed limit. If the vehicle is going between 11 and 14 miles over the posted speed limit, I'd stop and I'd write that vehicle a warning if everything was in order. Okay, if it was the bluebird, sunshine was out, it was the middle of July, it's a nice dry road, you get the point, right? The driver, sure. The driver didn't realize necessarily what they were doing or maybe new to the area. But you know, I remember stopping a vehicle one time at 14 miles an hour, and the roads were terrible. It was in the middle of winter, it was during a snowstorm. I go, what are you doing? You're going to flip this van. You're going to flip the van, you know? And so I gave that individual a ticket. That was about 25 years ago. So a lot goes into it. Typically, 15 or more miles over the posted speed limit is what I call, or what is termed as, gross deviation.
Okay.
From the motor vehicle, from the motor vehicle code, or from the accepted standard. Okay, typically, what that is that is really what the court looks at to determine this is per se unreasonable. And I will tell you from experience that if an officer writes a vehicle for 15 or more over the posted speed limit, writes a ticket for that, you know, the radar, let's assume they challenge the radar and the speed comes in, right? Because that's the only way. Yeah, you know, the radar wasn't calibrated, whatever. If that comes in at 15 or more miles over the posted, I don't know a judge in the United States that would say, I'll give you a warning for that. Because that's a lot. That 15 over the posted speed limit is a lot.
Has that ever worked? Somebody, you know, taking a speeding ticket like that to trial and getting it revoked?
No. Not in my almost 26 years of law enforcement, I've been to court a lot on speeding tickets. No. A judge is likely to reduce the fine amount, but you're still going to be convicted of speeding.
Right.
So.
Now, I don't know if they still do it, but I haven't had a ticket since 2006. But
good
the last time, I had one, I did fight it only because I didn't think I was the right car.
And that's possible.
Know,
I mean,
the car next to me was going much faster than I was.
If an individual can introduce reasonable doubt, not any doubt, but reasonable doubt, I think a judge is likely to cut you a break.
Well, he pled it down.
Okay.
He pled it down to 1 mile over.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to get
all right. So that
anyway.
Was a win.
So yeah, I guess it was a win. You know, at least the fine was relatively.
Yeah.
Modest.
So the judges often in situations like this will, you know, do the whole King Solomon thing, split the baby, right?
Right.
And that's what they did.
Okay. We're talking with Chief Dean Rondo of the Wolfboro Police Department, 569-5253. If you have a question or a comment, we're talking about police myths, and another one that I've always enjoyed is the what happens when a police officer crosses a city or a state line?
Nothing.
That's what I figured.
So we have this doctrine called, I'm assuming, like in terms of like fresh pursuit, right?
Is right.
What, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Nothing. We follow the doctrine of fresh pursuit. So if you cross the, you know, the town line or the state line or whatever the case may be, you're fine. You know, as long as you're actively pursuing a vehicle, you know, so, yeah.
Is there a time when you are out of your jurisdiction?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're not doing active, you know, there's no active pursuit, you know, then you have no right to exercise jurisdiction, your jurisdiction in another town or state's jurisdiction. You just don't have that, right? So if now the various times that we're following up on a criminal matter, we'll coordinate with that hosting agency and say, hey, you know, Conway, we're going to be up in your neighborhood. We want to link up with your detective. We're looking at, you know, these three people. We think this is connected to a burglary. And we want to go and ask them questions, you know, can you assign an officer or a detective to us? They'll go, oh, yeah, come on up. Yeah, yeah, let's see what you got. Maybe we might be able to tie up some cases here ourselves. So typically that's what you get. You know, we've done work in Maine on drug cases, on fraud cases, theft cases. Yeah, and that's the way it's done.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're talking about police myths here on WASR. I hope your Monday afternoon is going okay. I sure hope it went better than my Monday morning, but that's a different story entirely. The car still doesn't work.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it's been in now twice and still doesn't work, but it is what it is. There also is some misinformation going on with the new public safety building.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
can you kind of clear that up?
Yeah, yeah, we can talk about that. In fact, that's a great topic because it's coming up for vote. So I know there's a lot, and we don't, you know, and we never will, just so you know, and just so the listeners know, we're not going to engage on Facebook, right? We're just not going to do it, because that just doesn't make any sense to do that. Because, first of all, people, I think, they don't want to listen, they don't want to know, and they see it as challenging their knowledge, but there is a lot of misinformation going on out there about the public safety building. So the police station that we're in right now, which is the public safety building on South Main Street, it was built in 1972 or thereabouts. So we've been in that building about 50 years. There's a lot in that building. We've simply outgrown the building, and the fire department has too. When that building was built in 1972, it was a great building. Don't get me wrong. It's been maintained over the years. But there were issues with the building, right? It's old, it's tired, it needs to be rehabilitated. We have some foundation issues that need to be addressed. We have some structural issues that need to be addressed. We have code issues, right? Very important. We have code issues that need to be addressed. But more importantly, police science and fire science have evolved in the last 50 years. It'd be crazy to think that they haven't, especially with the fire department. You know, they're dealing with, you know, fires and burning houses and chemicals, and there's a lot that we've learned about how to reduce carcinogens and how to treat the firefighters coming back from these fires that may have been, you know, potentially exposed to these carcinogens. And the buildings need to have, you know, cold rooms and warm rooms associated with them where the firefighters can come in, derobe, they can decontaminate, they can take their bunker gear, right? That's the gear that they wear, their heavy coats and pants and boots and stuff, and get those things washed down and sprayed down where any chemicals and so forth are neutralized and cleaned up. There's a whole science behind that. There's a whole procedure on that, best practices. And the same thing on the police side relative to things like CLEAR that we've talked about on the show before, right? That's professional standards and logging of evidence and how we bring, you know, prisoners into the police station and how records are maintained and everything else that goes along with it, all the rest of it that, you know, how do you harden your infrastructure? How does dispatch function within, you know, within this realm of modern police science? And so communications and personal information is hardened and protected. So all of this is all part and parcel of, you know, public safety in the new millennia. And that building, unfortunately, doesn't allow us to do all of that, right? So the building, we have simply outgrown the building. Now, you got to remember, too, back in 72, the fire department was much smaller. The police department was much smaller, right? And so we're now basically living on top of each other, right? And I do mean that. We've outgrown the building. So the plan is no. So and just so you know, none of this should be a mystery to anybody. The reason I say that is in 2016, when we were going through the master plan, town has a master plan. The town spent a lot of money developing a master plan and all its facilities and infrastructure. It was identified in that document that was written, I want to say maybe 2008, that we will start the process for the construction of a new public safety building. And it was due to be completed in 2022. Well, that's this year. Mm-hmm. Now, we pushed it back a year because of COVID-19. And that's what happened, right? Things got a little wild and squirrely with COVID-19. So the point I'm making is that for any politician serving the town of Wolfboro to say that they didn't know what was going on, or this blindsided them, or they don't have any... It was identified in the master plan. So that seems to me to be a bad thing to say, that they didn't know about this. The other thing that we did is we established a building, public safety building committee, and it had citizen representation on it. The town manager put that out several years ago. We have been actively pushing this ball, if you will, kicking this ball down the football field for several years now, for at least, you know, a good 3 or 4 years. This ball has been moving down the football field. So, we have two members of the budget committee on this. We have some citizen involvement on this. Obviously, the fire chief, myself, my executive officer. This has gone through three town managers now, starting with Dave Owen. Now ending with Jim Pinio. Let's see, we have two selectmen representatives on this. You have two commissioners on this. All the meetings have minutes. There are schematics that have been done up by our architects. We've hired architects, and all of this information is on the town's website. Right? This is something else. All of this information is on the town website. So for someone to say, well, I don't understand why we need drawings. We already have drawings. Well, these are construction. So there's a Warren article moving forward. I'm sorry. There's a Warren article in this year's budget, Warren Article 23, which is for construction grade drawings and diagrams. Okay. These are a little bit different from a conceptual drawing where you're kind of looking at what is the building going to look like. You know, can we put a rose bush here? Let's get the right size of the building. Construction grade diagrams are things that deal with foundations and support columns and, you know, water and sewer trenches and the depth and soil testing and all this stuff that you do to make sure that you're building the building on the right foundation, that you have the right amount of drainage, that you have the right depth. The sewer lines are going to connect with what's already in the ground, and the water lines are going to connect what's already. So this is what I would call your blueprints, right? If, you know, if anybody ever took an architectural course in high school or college, these are your blueprints. These are the construction drawings that you're going to hand to, you know, somebody like Integrity Earthworks or you know, B&H Building, and they're going to come in and go, okay, yeah, we need a 24-foot, you know, retention wall. It's got to go down, you know, 16 feet, and it's got to be backfilled with, you know, 2.5 ton of crushed stone. That's what those drawings show. They tell the guys who are actually going to build this thing what size bolt to use, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's not an artist's rendition or an architectural schematic. It is the construction grade drawings that are used. And the drawings are the drawings. We have to have the drawings regardless of where we're going to put the building, okay? So I know there's some concern about some people talking about, well, you know, why do we have to have it at North Main Street? Why can't we? Well, we looked at a number of places, right? One of the places that we looked was on 109A, right? Everybody likes 109A. I liked it too. It was a great location. The town owns some property back there. But there were some real issues with that. And first and foremost is that's wetlands area, right? Oh. And that's a problem. Which means that, so yes, would it be possible to get permits to build in there? Sure. Sure, we could do that. We could file all those permits with the state and get permission to build in there. But you have to remediate the soil. You have to deal with the drainage issues. That causes the price tag to increase, right? I mean, you're talking a lot of money to do that. That's number one. Number two, that whole area is kind of off limits for us because it's where Eastern Propane has their storage tanks. Ooh. For propane and fuel oil. Ooh. Or at least propane. Yeah, so we're not going to put a police station with the town's communications center, right? Because dispatch belongs to me. We're not going to put it in that neighborhood. You don't want to put your police station in the potential hazardous zone for hazmat.
Right.
Okay. That doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. Talk to the town folk in Alton who have a fire station in a flood zone, right? And they're dealing with that issue now, right? And that's where Alton has a fire department that's right in a flood zone. So sure, that becomes problematic, right? There is a problem with that. So same thing, right? This is not, even though we like the location, right? Admittedly, it has a lot of pluses. I can't get around putting the police station, dispatch or not, can't get around putting the police station close to propane storage tanks. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
So what are you looking at?
So, let me go on. So we were looking at the old bank building, but that was bought by Brewster Academy before we had an opportunity to move on it. We did look at some land downtown in the center of town, down around the Clock Plaza area. Mm-hmm. And that land unfortunately is not available to us. We wanted to buy it, but that land isn't available to us because the owner wants to put a commercial enterprise in there, all right? And that's his choice or her choice. So we're limited. We want to keep the price tag on this low too, or as low as we possibly can. So we decided that looking at land that the town owned might be the best bet, right? We want to try to keep the price tag reasonable. And you know, we looked at the location out on 109 East by the 7-Eleven on the other side of 7-Eleven, where we have some property. Unfortunately, for what we needed to do, we didn't have enough property. We do have a wetlands issue, and that area can't be easily connected to water and sewer lines. Oh. So again, when we look at all of these issues, and we're trying to keep the price tag reasonable on this, it made sense to go with the North, what we call the North Main Street site, which is the old water tower site. Where we have enough land, where we have easy access to water sewer lines, and it's going to be a police station, not a combined facility. We felt that it was, the committee felt that it was much less expensive to do a police station in that location, and then to go back and remediate the issues at the fire station over a period of a few years and fix all that up. And there'll be concurrent, you know, when we're building the new public safety or the police station, there will be some concurrent construction ongoing to address some of the more serious remediation issues at the fire station. And then to buy time and then to gradually get at that building, because it is, we find it is still a useful building. But so at the end of the day, you'll have a police station at one end of town, a fire station at the other end of town. And then people say, well, you know, the police station is so far down. Well, first of all, it's not that far, number one. And number two, remember, you're talking to an infantryman, right? Everything's in walking distance. And number two is my officers are out on the road. They're not at the police station. My guys are out on the road. If they're at the police station, it's because they're either finishing a report or they're starting a report because they just arrested somebody. So my guys are out on the road. My officers, my men and women, they're out on the road. They're in town. I have officers. We have the town is divided into two sectors, Sector A and Sector B. I have officers in both. Okay, and that's the way we do business. My officers are out on the road. They're not at the station waiting for a call to come in. That's not the way it works. Okay. They're out on the road. They're doing motor vehicle enforcement, or they're answering calls for service, or they're meeting with individuals and so forth and so on. That's what they do.
Okay.
So I know a lot of people were kind of poking us in the eye and said, why didn't you look at here? Why didn't you look at? Yeah, we did. We did. And in fact, you can find all this material online. It's on the town's website. So you should go check it out.
Okay. How much money are we talking about for the new police?
So that's a tough question to answer. Right now we're looking at an estimate of about $6.1 million or $6.2 million in that neighborhood. But again, it's subject to all sorts of things. You know, COVID-19 has driven up the cost of materials. A few years ago, we were looking at a cost of 4.7. And so this is a great question. I'm glad you asked it. So, here's the answer. I don't know exactly how much it is, but I can tell you that, you know, we're looking at something that's 6.1, 6.2 million. But with the bond rates as low as they are right now, this is a great time to tackle some big projects. And this being one of them. Remember, this is identified in the town's master plan, okay? But this is a great time to deal with these projects because the bond rates are so low. So if you've got big infrastructure projects, now is the time to do it. The longer you wait on the public safety building or anything, the more expensive it's going to be. That's just the reality. And if we're not careful, and if there are too many naysayers out there because they don't understand or are not willing to listen, and this gets delayed, this could be incredibly pricey down the road. Because I'll tell you right now, you're not going to get by with that building much longer. All right, the one we're in right now, it just isn't going to happen. It is in serious need of rehabilitation, and. So my best recommendation is let's fix it now, right? I mean, so as an Army officer and as a chief of police, right, I look at risk. I look at how do you mitigate that risk. I look at issues. I look at addressing issues and fixing issues. This is an issue. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be fixed. And we need to do it, and we need to do it now. And kicking the can down the road because you're unhappy with the location that the building is going in, to me, is not really, that's just not a very viable reason for delaying this. You know, at the end of the day, no matter where the police station goes, someone is going to have an issue with it, right?
Right.
And so I'm not sure this is one that, you know, is a problem, right? This is where I agree. Is this a problem or is this your problem? And, you know, I heard some people say, well, it's in a residential area. Let's put it down on Lena Street. Okay, stop. Isn't Lena Street a residential area? Yeah. And how do you think the residents on Lena Street are going to feel? So that wasn't a very bright comment for somebody to make. And then Lena, you know, the issue is, you know, you need a certain amount of property to put the building,
mm-hmm.
right? And we don't have that much property on Lena Street. Okay. I'm not sure Lena Street is a very good location for a police station. And we did look at Lena Street. We looked at several locations on Lena Street. That's another area that we looked at. We did look at quite a lot. We also, and it's important to note, we took a lot of visits around to different towns and looked at different building and construction methods, and we looked at we looked at some police stations and did our research. So all of this again is on the town's website, and you can look at that. You look at those documents. I'm not seeing the issues, and I would if I did see something, I would say, that's a good issue. I'm not seeing the issues on being very viable on putting it down on North Main Street where the proposed location is. It'll be back off the road. It's going to be a nice design of a building. It'll blend in. It's not going to be that noisy. We're not going to be screaming in and out of there because where my officers are out on the road. They are out on the road. So, yeah. Typically, we don't bring, we don't come screaming with our lights and siren into the police station, right? That doesn't typically happen. I'm just, some of the issues that I've seen that have come up seem to be, it's going to destroy the character of, no, it won't.
So how much flack have you been getting on this?
I haven't been getting all that much flack. I have seen some comments on Facebook on a couple of various sites. Everything About Wolfboro is one of them, where people are kind of attacking this. And there's a number of people. They seem to be, a handful of folks that are going after this building and they want it on, or at least one individual wants it on 109A, right down by the old Wickers warehouse. But I've explained that, and I did tell that individual we can't put it down there because of the hazmat. It's in close proximity to the hazmat. If there's a propane leak or an explosion, potentially you could be causing a lot of destruction and damage to your police department and to the communications facility. You don't want that.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, you can't do. Yeah, you can't do that.
What else are some of the big myths that you hear a lot of?
Well, in terms of public safety building, or just myths in general?
Myths in general.
Well, one of my favorite ones that I remember trying to address years ago was, if police are running radar on the road, they need to have their lights on. So let me address that one right now.
I don't think they do.
No. They don't. They don't have to have their lights on, And I don't know where that came from. I don't know why they believe that. Yeah, the cops had his lights out. I got a ticket, so I'm going to get over on this one. No. There's nothing in the rule book that says I got to have my lights on if I'm running radar.
Well, I know Massachusetts leaves their lights on, but I don't know if that's a law or if that's just a safety thing.
It might be a safety thing from their perspective. Sure, you don't want to get hit. It's always better to be seen. When I run radar, even as a chief, I still run radar. I leave my radar on, right? We have the on again, off again switch on the radar, so you're not actively transmitting. But I look at it like, if your radar detector goes off, that's great. That's what I want. Because what do you do when your radar detector goes off?
You slow down.
Exactly. I'm looking for voluntary compliance with the law. So I just leave my radar on.
I've also heard that when a police officer stops you, he already knows what he wants.
No, not true.
No?
No. I know at the academy, so when you go to the New Hampshire Police Academy, when we're all graduates of the New Hampshire Police Academy, they try to get you to think along the lines you should, in order to be fair, you should already have your mind made up whether this person is getting a ticket or not. And to me, now that's not a rule, that's their suggestion, but to me, I want to see the driver. I want to make a determination as to their fitness behind the wheel of a vehicle. I want to see what their logic and reasoning is. So there's a lot of things I want to speak to that driver about, you know, what they're doing and why it's dangerous. So a good example, I think I may have told you the story once before on the show, but this is one of my favorite ones. So I was a brand new patrolman. I'd been on the road for maybe a couple of years, and I'm out on 109 East, and I got a guy, and he's doing 14 over the posted speed limit, right? And this is over by the beaches. And so I turn around, spin around, and pull him over, and I get in behind him, and he was a big guy, huge, you know, tall and wide. And he gets out of the car, he slams the door, he starts charging the cruiser. So I wait till he gets right up to the cruiser, I put the car in reverse, and I back up about 50 feet. And I'm on the PA, telling, hey, sir, you need to get back in your vehicle, you need to get in. And he gets just madder. And remember, he's a big guy. Right. He's big. And like the biggest, one of the biggest guys I've ever seen. And he comes charging at the cruiser again. I put the car in reverse back up another 50 feet. Now he's like winded. Hey, sir, you need to get back in your vehicle. And he turns around. He now walks back about 100 feet or so. And he's winded. He's winded. So I pull the cruiser up and keeping an eye on him. And I call in the plate. And I go up and I get his license and his registration from him, and you know, he's yelling and screaming at me, and you're stopping me. Yeah, I'm stopping you. And so I said, wait right here. Yeah, I'm gonna go back. And so I call the license in for a license check, and he's from New York, and the car's properly registered, his license is good, no issues there. And I ask for a New York 2122, right? I want to check the status and his motor vehicle history. And the dispatcher just starts reading this guy's motor vehicle history. He's got ticket after ticket after ticket after ticket for all manner of motor vehicle offenses, least of which is speeding, right? I mean, he's got all these speeding violations. So I write everything down, you know, I go up. And I give the guy a written warning for speed. And I give him his license registration back. And he says, what? You're not giving me a ticket? I said, no, I'm just giving you a written warning. I just want you to slow down. He had two children in the car. And they were in the back seat belted in their car seats. Everything was right and proper. His speed was just a little high. And he starts crying. I was so mean to you. Oh, my God. And you're giving me a break. And I explained to him. I said, hey, sir. I said, let me tell you something. I said, you know, your attitude aside, which was poor, admittedly, you weren't going fast enough for me to give you a ticket. You were going fast enough for me to stop and warn you about the speed and the various dangers in this area. My effort in my attempt to stop you, my intent is to be educational and not punitive. However, if you were going 1 mile an hour or more over the posted speed limit, I would have definitely given you a ticket because that is just too fast, especially with two beautiful children in the back of your car. So I know this fellow appreciated it. And he said so, and he wrote a nice letter to the chief of police on my behalf, and that was nice and all that, but it certainly wasn't asked for, and he admitted, and he was very apologetic that he was so poor to me during that motor vehicle stop. But the point is that I got him thinking, right? And hopefully I made much more of an impact than giving him a ticket. Now, could I have given him a ticket? Sure. But that's not what I did then. You know, and so I did have this rule that I'd like to hold true to. And I know a lot of officers do the same thing.
Okay. In our remaining roughly 5 minutes, I want to talk a little bit about automated license plate reading equipment.
Yes.
I see it a lot in, what is that show? Parking Wars in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
where they drive around and this thing scans license plates and it beeps when you got a hit, and then they boot it or tow it, depending on,
yep,
you know, whatever. Do you know, you know, is this coming?
I think it is. You know, right now in the state of New Hampshire, I don't think those are legal.
Oh.
But just like everything else, it's newer technology. It has a place. It has a purpose. I will tell you that, you know, one of the things that I used to look for years and years and years ago, back then you could do this without too much difficulty, was, you know, you'd go to a parking lot after, you know, a day or two after a major snowstorm, you find vehicles that were still snow covered. You check the plates because they may be stolen. And oftentimes what was happening, and I found many vehicles, stolen vehicles that way, these bad guys and gals, they steal these vehicles and then they dump them. They just park them in a parking lot. You see this in malls a lot, right, where, you know, a vehicle will turn up stolen, you know, 3 years earlier, and they found it during a snowstorm, right? And they get the plate run by the local police department, and this vehicle hasn't moved in 3 years, and tires are all flat and everything else. Yeah, well, yeah, it's been abandoned for 3 years. Somebody stole it out of Rhode Island and dropped it at the mall in New Hampshire, you know, so very common.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Now, I don't know. I'm not familiar with this show, Parking Wars, but I imagine it's parking tickets. Registrations are another one. So, yeah, I mean, Philadelphia is obviously seeking sources of revenue, and they want their laws followed. So this is a great way, an automated way to do that.
Yeah, you might want to check your TV listings for it. It's called Parking Wars.
Yeah, I've never
heard
of it.
A&E has it. I don't know what other channels have it.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's funny.
To watch, you know, parking
enforcement. It's coming. And you know what? Pretty soon I think you'll see them on the side of the road. There'll be a trooper there you know, you'll be going under a toll booth and bam, I'll bet you it sends a message. Hey, the stolen vehicle, hey, unregistered vehicle, hey, outstanding, revoked registration or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, now, you'll see that.
In our remaining couple of minutes, let's talk about people that you seem to stop repeatedly. There's got to be a list of frequent flyers. And
no, not really.
No?
No.
I figured you'd be on the road or whatever, and it's like, it's him again?
No.
Or her again?
No, really? No, we don't. No, there isn't. You know, sure. I mean, sometimes you stop the same person, you know, twice in the same day. Yeah, but that doesn't happen very often, and we don't have that. We really don't. Doesn't exist. Yeah. So.
Right. It is 12:58. We got a couple of minutes left with the police chief, Dean Rondo. How can people get more information on the new police building?
So you can go to town, look on the town website. There's a link to all the documents, the schematics of the buildings and everything that's been done and who's on the committees. And you can Google that. You can obviously call the town manager's office, call one of the committee members. And talk to them. We're doing a on Wolfboro Community TV. I'm finishing the show and then heading back, and we have Wolfboro Community TV doing a tour of the Wolfboro Police Station, Fire Station. We'll be we're taking folks through the building. If you want, come up, schedule a tour. Come on up and look at and see how tired the building is, and learn what some of the issues are and why we're trying to address the issue of a new public safety building or a new police station and a rehabilitated fire station. It's really the right thing to do. This building has to be addressed. The problems in it are big, and they're only going to get worse if they don't get addressed. This is the best way to do it, and now is the time.
Okay.
Thank you.
And, of course, as you know, town meeting is coming up next month.
Oh, we have today's the 7th.
Right.
8 February is the town's deliberative session.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Yeah, please vote yes on Warren Article 23. That is for the construction grade drawings. I explained to you why that's so important. But the town's deliberative session is Tuesday, tomorrow, 8 8th February, and it's at the Kingswood Art Center. And I'm not sure what time that is. I think maybe 7 p.m., but check that.
I'm sure the...
That information is on the town's website.
The website.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, it is 1 o'clock. Thank you again for a very interesting discussion.
Thank you, sir.
And enjoy your time with Wolfboro Community TV.
Thank you, sir.
1 o'clock. News is next.